they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, folks, welcome down the Security Rabbit Hole to another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is Raph, and I am here in the flesh in, I don't know, where are we, McKinney?
You're in McKinney.
I'm in McKinney. I'm hanging out at an office building here in some nondescript area. I get to interview somebody fun today that I think you guys will appreciate, particularly from the intelligence community side and in interesting threat intelligence space and stuff like that. So Tom McDowell is with the Retail and Hospitality ISAC. And if you find yourself asking, wait, what? Yeah, I did that too. But I'll let him tell us about that. So with no further ado, Tommy.
Yeah, thank you, Raphael. What's the RSIC before? And people had a hard time pronouncing that language. It was the Retail ISAC that was really inside of the Retail Intelligence Analysis Sharing Center. So I think they tried to use those acronyms to encapsulate both, but a lot of people had problems with it. So
I couldn't pronounce it.
I'm trying to come up with a new one. I don't have it yet. So our new name is the Retail and Hospitality ISAC. Of course, large retail members, about 136 companies out there, and we have a large number of hotels and hospitality type organizations that are a little bit unique compared to the other retail environment. So I believe that had to do with a lot, you know, toward the name change.
So hospitality, you're talking about regular hotels and, you know, the big names?
All the big names, a lot of the casinos, you know.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they have the hotels associated with them. That's probably some of the largest industry sector that we have. There are a few of the independent hotels and, the name brands, you would recognize who they were. But the most of them are around the casino industry.
Okay. So you've this is not your first rodeo. You've been around the industry for a bit. Tell us a little bit about your history and kind of how you got here.
Yeah, you know, everybody has a story, right?
So some are better than others.
You know, I was with the judicial branch right before 9/11 and ran cybersecurity threat intel for the federal judiciary.
Okay, and, that's interesting.
It was an interesting world. I got war stories on that one I can tell you about.
Literally.
Many. Military before that. And so 9/11 hit. I had a little six-month contract. Went out on my own to build cybersecurity programs for critical infrastructure in the western U.S. around power generation. Grand Coulee, Hoover Dam, CVACs, and some of the big power generation facilities.
That's interesting.
Six-month contract, turned it in 13 years. It was amazing. I couldn't even spell SCADA when I first went there, but I learned real quickly. And to see
pretty much like everybody, though, right? Because suddenly overnight we had a million experts in SCADA, and most people didn't know what that stood for.
Nobody knew what it stood for. It was amazing at that time because these were the engineering community. The computers and networks, they were on a wall. They built their own. I mean, a lot of the databases and protocols, they were built by engineers. They weren't proprietary. Today, though, those generation transformer station, there's probably about 140 IP embedded devices, you know, for each pair of generator and transformer. And so the proliferation of routed networks has just taken over. And so you can see the vulnerability and the disparity that you get in those kind of systems, interconnectivity across the grid for stabilization. So anyway, 13 years went by and did a lot of work with NIST to write some of their standards document. And I really saw an evolution because at that time, there was a lot of program orientation to security.
Right.
And you could have a great program. A lot of people took a lot of risk. The compliance world took over. The NERC-SIP standards and some of the other language came in, took the conversation from a risk base to really down the hall to lawyers and fines.
Oh, good.
It changed, exactly, totally changed the conversation around security.
Right.
And, okay, you can have good controls in place, but can you detect? Can you respond? Can you actually perform? Left, went to work with Mandiant. Had a really good, great company back then. Took part in someone with Sony breach. Traveled around
the
world.
That must have been fun.
It was fun. Spent a lot of time in Australia and other parts of the world building security programs in some large international banks. And all of a sudden, we got bought by FireEye. if you remember that deal.
I remember that vividly.
And it was like, I don't want to work for a stinking hardware company. So I left, went to work with Insight Partners.
Okay.
And ran their threat intelligence services division for a while. Then we got bought by FireEye.
You're like, I'm seeing a trend here.
Seeing a trend here. So it was like, Tom, you know everybody in all these three companies, so why don't you come help merge the services side of this together for everyone?
Nice.
So I did, and it was really a unique challenge. Three totally different philosophies to detection and response and intel.
Yeah.
And some really great friends still there today. And then in 2016, I left and again went out on my own. And then in January, around December 17, Susie Squire, executive director, had just came back to the retail ISAC and was sort of rebuilding their intel sharing program. And I said, well, this would be a unique challenge. Let me see what this is about. So I jumped in, been here now a year and a half.
Nice. So when you guys, when you kicked this thing off, or when you got here, right, what was the first thing that you dove into that needed to needed your attention?
Well, the first thing was I had to try to identify in the community, what are your top threats?
Right.
We have no telemetry here. So we rely on individual members to share intel with us.
Right.
That was a big step for me. I'm used to having my own telemetry, pulling in my own logs, doing that kind of assessment, or at least looking at them. And now you have to rely on others. So the first thing there to realize was this is very much a people communication community built on relationship. That's the foundation to make this work. If you don't have that built first, and trust built with those members sharing intel.
Yeah, I was going to say that they have to trust you to be able to give them information.
Absolutely. And so then the first thing we do is to lay that foundation, look at the top threats, the level of intel being shared, what type of where are the gaps with these companies? We have some companies out there that have very large, well-funded intelligence shops. And then we have others that may have one or two man teams. And then there's a large, another 30, 40%. It's outsourced.
Yeah.
And others don't have any. So broad range of disparity as far as what people can really collect and act on.
Are you finding that, so along that vein, I'm curious for my own investigation, is that a function that intelligence particularly, right, the gathering of information, refining, processing, and not necessarily doing anything with, but they gather, is that something you find that is becoming a kind of a necessary thing to have in-house, or is that still something that's fairly easy to outsource?
You know, it's a little bit of both. I would like to say it's fairly easy to outsource, but I think the biggest thing, there's two trends. One is you can have great intelligence, but if you don't have the ability to consume it, act on it, have the security programs in place, you're not going to be able to move it really far down the road. And that's the challenge with a lot of the smaller retailers, as well as some of those that outsource a lot of that to other independent companies. So that's a little bit of a challenge how to move that. The other big one there is what is your mission behind it? What are your threat actors? Where are your top risks? What does that threat vector to those risks actually look like?
Yeah, that's fair.
Then we can start lining up key risks, key threats, and using intel to drive the investments of where we should be putting our security controls and that type of investment. Whereas before, it was just, you got a SOC cert, throw intel in, and block everything and respond. That's sort of reactive mode.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is get ahead of that game so we can get a little bit more strategic. And again, if you're a mature company and you have those organizational assets, you can make that happen. If you're smaller, it's a little more difficult.
So there's a lot of, we mean mixing maturity in with company size, I think is kind of where the lines are drawn, right? What is it? I think company size isn't necessarily indicative of whether they'll have an ability to respond or not.
That's true.
But it does weigh heavily on whether you'll be able to make the investment to have a team of people sitting around effectively collecting information and then thinking basically of brain trust. You know, I work in the mid-market every day for a job. So for me, the kinds of companies I deal with, that global, we'll call them Fortune 5,000, 10,000, they're lucky if they've got, a couple of a pair of analysts, much less intel, right?
So. Correct. I see the same trend here. And then also, within this community, fraud is a big and growing concern. So it gets real interesting. The last week I was at the Fraud and Breach Summit in Chicago. common theme was, how do we define fraud inside of organizations? Great deal of disparity around that. Many people, the analysts would come in and go, well, I track down phishing and do all the blocking and do this. And I'm going, like, that sounds like threat intel to me.
Yeah.
Where's fraud fit into that? It's such a concern that they're trying to get more standards around this right now.
Well, and I think a lot of the banks or the financial industry is focused heavily on things like account takeovers, right?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, you guys are part of the hospitality industry. I've got a bajillion Marriott points. If those disappear, I'm going to be pretty upset, right?
You better know it.
I spent some time accruing that. Yes. I want to use it. I don't want to see it go away.
Yeah, you know what? I'm right there with you, and I'm the same way. It's almost that the email vector, you know, of course, and phishing,
yeah,
and all the attacks that come through,
yep,
you know, of course, that typically falls into the IR shop and the threat intel people to respond. But the fraud on top of it. You know, the activities being taken on top of it. That's where the play sort of comes to be. But, again, a broad disparity out there. So that's why a sharing community like ours, and we've had great success in the last year and a half, because we have some core founder leaders that they believe that this sector is only going to survive if there's confidence in the consumer that they can buy online. So a lot of our core members provide a tremendous amount of sharing of intel who have those resources so that we can take those threats and identify IOCs, best practices, security controls, and make those available to others in our community.
That's interesting. Well, so, I mean, look, the online, everything is going online, whether you want to, you know, buy a book, rent a hotel room, rent a car, like whatever you're doing. But as the global playing field gets leveled and most everybody gets a website and ways to transact online, you know, you can get different payment platforms and all that. So that's kind of leveling the platform. But that is becoming a major mechanism of commerce. And you mentioned the word trust. Trust is both important in your members talking to each other and to you, and then their consumers talking to them. So there's a lot of trust. There's a lot of wording around trust in that kind of conversation.
You know, there is, and our trust is in that the community. We're here to work with you, and we're not going to release your information, and we're going to build that teaming effect.
Yeah.
And I think if you went to our members and said what works with us is we've got so many first name conversations that we went and built with people. And you have these people. You know people through your career that you've worked with.
You
pick up the phone tomorrow
and you call
and have an honest conversation. Here's what I'm struggling with. There you are.
Yeah.
I believe that can be built. That doesn't just happen by default.
Sure.
You may have done it, but I think we can refine that skill. And we've done that tremendously. Now, that's great, but that alone will not make you secure. You got to take that trust and build it into your system level as well. And even that for a motivator share. An analyst can be committed as much as they want to share intel, but as long as it's human-driven, we're going to get the drops. There's just no way to sustain that over time. If that analyst takes off, our sharing goes down. So our trend is to start identifying machine-to-machine ways of sharing intel.
Well, that's what I want to pull on that for a second,
okay,
because that's interesting, because a decade ago, maybe not even, 5-6 years ago maybe, right, every conference you go into would be threat intelligence and it would be sharing, and we were like, nobody's going to share. So we kind of got people over that hump. Not everybody. We got people over that hump, that whole – the legal barriers to information sharing, right? So legal teams got okay with it. Things started moving. And then now it's a how do we get the human beings – away from being the singular bottleneck here, effectively,
correct,
right? Because, like you said, somebody goes on vacation, the process can't stop.
That's right. That's right. Well, one thing to realize is that every company has their own workflow and their own technology. So if you think we're ever going to get everybody on one platform, it's not going to happen. Or in one particular type of tool that we could buy and have everybody have a part. It's just not going to happen. So integrations are our key. Things like we have some companies that use ServiceNow as a ticketing within their threat intel platform. Can you build a threshold, even if it's manually selected, that once that reaches a certain threshold of maturity, they can have that click sent into us is one way to do it.
That's interesting.
Another way is we do have some common platforms. TruStar is one of those that has enclaves in a large number of these organizations, and there's very easy ways there to share intel with us through those enclaves. In many cases, they're identifying the enclaves by the TLP maturity, TLP red or amber, and they segregate data that way. That's one way to do it. And there's many other ways that we're exploring. You know, how can we get better integrated into their workflow? Now, let's get real. every company is going to have some level of risk or sensitivity with what can be released to us.
Sure.
And there still is disparity there. The attorneys still get in and they shut things down. On many instances, we have had those conversations with attorneys to assure them that we're here to protect the public. I don't need to know who got breached or how much you were lost, but if you can give me TTPs or techniques or what you're seeing that your fellow people in business should be protecting,
yeah,
you can share that with us. And a lot of times, those conversations have made a big difference.
Well, and that seems to be, I mean, logically thinking through that, you're like, well, how hard can it be? Like, I don't want the details of the result. I just want the who and the how.
Right.
Right? And I don't want to know what happened. I just need to know what the issues were, what led up to it, how they exploited.
Exactly.
But that data is exceptionally sensitive, obviously.
It is.
So that it's got to be – look, you talked about integrations. I think integrations are sort of the thing that's both helping and hindering the security industry right now, right? It's been – for 20 years that I've been in this space, we seem to build centers of excellence, tools that are better at one thing than another. And I like this one, you like that one, and we fight over which one's the standard. And then we try to go build standards, and they're not really standards. Or they're a standard that allows you to implement it in 15 different ways, which doesn't help.
Right.
So how do you guys get, how do you fight that? Because that's a battle you've got to be in every day.
It is a battle every day, and we all deal with it. There are some of those larger tools out there. The trend I'm seeing now is the much smaller use of technology, and integration is the key. A lot of the larger companies will buy smaller tools that fit inside of that workflow and in the existence they already have. It's a great career to be a Python programmer right now that can do a lot of these integrations. There's a high demand for that. But I do see more integrations like that happening, using tools, a lot of the open source too. MISP is making a huge comeback now, not comeback, really an arrival in the U.S., well-known overseas. I had one of my team members visit there this summer, and we plan to do some training here in the U.S. So we're seeing a large interest turning toward that type tool set. Difference is you got to invest in your people. You got to have the skill capability
that's
to be able
trend
to support
across
that.
Every single security conversation,
it is.
Literally every.
And I'm like you, been in this business a long time, and I can remember back in that critical infrastructure days, you give me the MacGyver type guys, you know what I mean? You know that name.
Yeah.
They can make anything happen.
Yeah.
I will educate that kind of person. They will make shareware screen. They will make every tool work.
Sure.
Just dated myself on that one. But that skill set is what we need to invest in, I think.
Yeah.
Instead of throwing a large amount of money and technology at a problem and some of these large solutions that, like you said, they don't always work.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone through the last 2 months looking at all the different tip manufacturers out there, and they're built for a very limited use case, and there's always customization that has to occur.
Well, that's it, right? This started back with the SIM.
It did.
It's a box of Legos, and it don't include instructions because you get to build whatever it is that you'd like. And you're like, well, that's great, but how do you and I build the same thing when we know we're both in different rooms, can't talk to each other, and our companies won't let us share what the other one's building?
The maturity of the industry still is not there. And so that's where I see the void of this open source type of window coming in now. And like I said, the interest around MISP is substantial. Now, whether or not it's going to be able to sustain it, because you got to have the skill set to maintain that. You know? And the potential is there. I'd love to see that investment turn.
Yeah.
But we'll see what the industry does with it.
Well, and so how are you guys – look – the specificity of the individual ISACs, information analysis and kind of sharing
centers.
Intel centers,
right.
They're specific to the industry. Do you guys all talk amongst each other for kind of the big picture?
We do. There's several, especially in our sector. Of course, you know the PD-63 back in 98 started identifying these critical infrastructure sectors that the ISACs came from. And then you had in 2015, I believe it was, one of the acts that created the information sharing analysis organizations that were supposed to go after the gap that were not really in a critical infrastructure, but maybe a geographical area or a port or something like that.
Yep.
So we stay in contact with those quite a bit. It is interesting because not everybody in an ISAC or ISAL comes from the intelligence community.
Okay,
so those of us that did sort of come in with this intelligence workflow, this intelligence lifecycle, as a model to do this work. Not everybody does that.
Yeah.
And you introduce the word sharing. You know, it's a weird word. You know, it's like I'd rather see the word exchange. Sharing comes with it all this other
baggage,
morass, and baggage with it. Exactly, that really gets in the way of building something that will be workable. So you see some startup, and their role is to provide a facility so that sharing could occur. They're really just facilitators of the sharing. They don't get involved in much of the intel sharing at all. Others go a step higher, and they may enrich what is shared. They may take some of the indicators, run it through their tools. Some now are actually starting to involve where they're providing a service. You know, they go out and actually get contracts with either in collections, or they're actually providing some type of analysis for their members.
Right.
You know, and then it becomes more of a service orientation.
So where do you guys fit?
We're a little bit of both. We're evolving. No doubt. We have I have three analysts on my team, and we do enrich the shared intel that we have. This last year, we've worked really hard with our team to come up with identified intel requirements for our top threats that we could agree on, and methods to tag the data that we actually collect.
Yeah.
And in many cases, we are securing contracts with intel providers and others so that we can go out and collect, not just in open source, but in those feeds as well, so that we can feed back into this pool. And then we assist, you know, the evolution of that intel inside the organizations.
So with that said, do you see the need to build and hire kind of a almost like a SOC here within RHISAC, or are you guys more, you see the evolution more into a refinement rather than a collection?
Today I see it more as a refinement. The possibility does exist in what you just said. It really depends on the community, and that really is the group that drives this, and it depends on what that functionality is. There are some mature, you know, some organizations out there that just because of their threat, ITISAC is a good example. The biggest thing they're concerned there is vulnerabilities with IT. So you can see their approach to maintaining exploits, threats to those vulnerabilities, a little different orientation of what to share, and then the tool to use to best share it than one that ours that's dealing with everything from Java scraping to, you know, websites to some of the new POS malware to all the ATO type threats coming through. Ours is a little different threat vector.
I was going to say to that point, right? What you just said is you guys have you do retail and hospitality. So hospitality, I guess, is a specialized version of retail.
It is.
It's but you've got unique problems in the hospitality space and casinos specifically, right there, right, that don't exist in other other market segments, other communities. What do you think what is your biggest what's the thing that you guys are faced with the most right now that's probably the biggest security threat?
Largely, there's several. I think largely because of the third party structure that supports the hotel industry, from the payment industry to the registration pages, and the proliferation of that. You know, it used to be you just go in the hotel and register. Now that's all online. We recognized this back last year when it was British Airways, you know, got hit by the Bates card type threat. And we were very concerned then because a lot of that vulnerability has to do with tags. And tags are those kind of JavaScript applets that are put on websites so a marketing can track your movement of your mouse and what you're registering.
Oh, yeah.
Well, those were very vulnerable. And we knew then that, you know, why would an actor try to go against a big manufacturer or a big retailer who may have the security? If they can just get into the tag library, then they're going to get distributed to all the other members. And sure enough, you know, Everline, the French company, was hit in January.
Well, it's really funny. When I used to work for GE way back in the early 2004, 2005 timeframe, one of the things that was always pushed back on was the inclusion of trackers, right? Those little tracker applets are, you know, zero pixel images and all that stuff. And we're like, okay. And back then it was Google that was the major ones. Google, I forget the other ones, but like, but what if they were ever? I mean, that's back then. I can't imagine how much more complex it's gotten since then.
And it's still evolving. I think it was, there have been several new skimming type attacks that have come out recently. And we're tracking sniffer toolkits on sale on the dark web. So those things, you can go buy them now and just go to work with that real easy. You don't have to be that skill of an actor anymore. I mean, that underground market is amazing. So we're very concerned about the escalation of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really interesting. If you've been around this business long enough, you know, there's that sort of upward curve where these exploits sort of get recognized in the market. Bad guys start copying each other, and they may make a few little tweaks. And then all of a sudden, somebody gets really brilliant. You know, they hit, people learn, you react to them, they go away, then they come back, and somebody really nails it hard. It's like on that second part of the slope, to speak, when they're coming down, when that creative monster really takes off. Well, the same thing applies to these guys. So we don't think we've seen the full impact of that one yet, because it's just so prolific, and it's very hard to stop and detect.
Something I've noticed is that particularly in the retail space, and heck, well, let me back up. In the hotel space, you know, having checked into my share of hotels and yours, and I think everybody else's, I have seen some, we'll say, severely dated systems at those terminals. I have literally watched back when the airline mergers were happening, which isn't too long ago, watched people log into DOS terminals, and I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, what? Did I walk into a time warp? Like, what is going on here? And they're like, we're still doing that. It's still command line.
And, you know, I really get concerned there as well, because as I walk into a lot of retail shops, the one things I'm really concerned about that we're still seeing escalate are the POS malware.
Uh-huh.
You know, you had Caribou Coffee and a few of these other people hit right before the end of the year.
Yep.
Huddle House got hit right after that, a lot of others. And many times I go into a retailer and they've got tape over the chip.
I know. You know,
and
still,
they can just watch still.
So it was October, 2 years ago, right?
Yes. You did see, it was interesting, the Brian Breach report came out just not too long ago, and they did a comparison between 2014 and 18, and no doubt, if you just looked at those two as independent measures, there is a great reduction.
Sure.
But by the time the last part of November came out, we saw a large amount of POS malware
back
escalating. Fin7 has been identified.
Yeah.
And some,
while we're on
some,
7.
Yeah, Fin7 has picked. Fin6 was in that market for a while. They did. They dropped away. They sort of went to the ransomware roles and playing more of that. But Fin7 has picked up the pace, and they are very strong in the area. We've seen some very sophisticated type attacks coming out, and we expect that one to continue simply because we don't have it enforced across all the retailer. And you got to remember, too, it's the payment system all the way back. There's a lot of de-tokenization along that path.
Oh, I remember having these conversations.
Yes. Yes. And so if you're still not aware of that, you've got a lot of vulnerability. And I've been in the physical stores. You know, come on. It's sometimes you get a network room in a rack in a closet in the back of a remote store, you know.
I'm very familiar with these, unfortunately.
It's still that same. I mean, a lot of progress has been made, but we've got a long way to go.
So where's this? Like, where's the evolution of sort of the services that the ISAC provide? You guys particularly provide. What do you see as the contribution you're making, and kind of what's the thing you're trying to cut down on, decrease, minimize? Like, what's the goal, right?
Yeah.
What's the end result here we're shooting at?
We say that our mission is to reduce the risk to the overall community.
Yeah.
By sharing best practices and threat information. That's sort of our way we see our impact. What we see trending is a larger role we can play in that community, especially of taking relevant threat intel and identifying quickly those IOCs are threat actors. You know, to manage a threat actor and do it right is not a cheap undertaking.
Yeah.
You've got to have highly skilled people who really are dedicated and know what they're doing.
Right.
A lot of the mid-sized companies, they can't afford it.
They just
can't do it. So that is one area where we've been able to try to start filling in the gap and then start monitoring the collection so that we can start identifying some of the more trends that we're seeing. That's one big area. The other big area, too, that I'm really excited about is more the data analysis. When you go back and look at what is being shared with our membership and start plotting that over time, compare that to the actual breaches that are happening, and then start comparing that data to some of the detection capability that's going on in our organization, we're starting to see some really interesting exploration and correlations between those different data sets that we've never looked at before to start telling us what we're doing. One last year, for example, we had a very high correlation last year between our sharing and breaches that were announced. So I went back, looked, and we said, okay, what does that mean? Well, it probably means an analyst wants to share more when a breach hits the news and their CEO is going, hey, what happened about that breach? Should we pay attention to it? What that tells me is we're still behind the curve. Yeah. We're still reactive. And so far this quarter, if I could show you a chart, you know, it looks like we finally broke that. We have true collection sharing of intel based on risk, you know, based on threats that are evolving, not tied to what's actually occurring in the news.
Okay.
So that type of broader analysis that we've only begun to explore.
Now, what kind of organizations it take to, and I guess what kind of level of effort to take to get ahead of some of these threats? Because it's one thing to get for a company to get hit by POS malware and then go, oh, hell, I should tell others about it, right? Mm-hmm. That's great. That's the old antivirus model. Somebody's patient zero. How close are we to preventing patient zero?
You know, I know of a handful of companies that are mature enough to start capturing, you know, have the attack vector identified so that they know their key systems, vulnerabilities to those systems, patch levels, and where they haven't patched because it would break things, which is typically the case.
So that's, okay, let's go back to this in a second.
Yeah. So that is the key place to start, is to know, you know, what are your critical inventory and where are your key risks. Once you do that, then you can sort of start mapping up the threats we see now and then get ahead. I think the biggest game is you got to get to the criminal undergrounds.
Yeah.
And start watching for example, if all of a sudden a particular POS malware is starting to be sold on the underground and it exploits a vulnerability, and you know that 90% of your systems have that vulnerability, you haven't patched it, then that risk level starts to go up. I haven't seen that type of maturity really implemented yet, but people are talking about it. They're trying to move in that direction.
Well, okay, so that is exceptionally interesting because so the intel sharing space, the conversation as it happened, what, even 5 years ago or more, was all about indicators and AOCs,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now what you're saying, though, it's not just about the outside in, what are the bad guys doing and how are they attacking me? It's, hey, I'm vulnerable to this. Who else has this?
Exactly.
Like, how are you guys treating this vulnerability? So that, but that's necessarily harder, that's more reliant on people.
It is. But that is exactly what's happening. It's not just how do we get a hold of it, but what are the defense practices against it?
Oh, that's
how do you share it? I think one thing we do at the RHISAC, we have something called RFIs, where members can come in and request information of us. And it's interesting. Over the last year, we have more RFIs about systems capability, configuration, controls, GDPR, and some of the compliance legislation. People are very, very concerned about this. So the whole role of what we provide, you know, is changing, no doubt about it. The sharing of those best practices is exactly why you come to an organization like us.
Yeah.
Most of the time, everybody's dealing with the same type issues. So you can come in as a community, have those open conversations without disclosing your own vulnerability, and come to learn and move from it. You've got to create that. You've got to create that trust for that to happen. But it is happening.
So
the great benefit comes from that.
So how do you keep that kind of momentum going? Because I know that, you know, nothing helps an organization, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but nothing helps an organization like an ISAC, like a major breach in that market sector.
Right.
Because suddenly people are like, you know what, I should start paying attention.
Yes.
But over time, that drops, that willingness and that eagerness and that, because it takes effort to share, right?
It does.
It's easy to consume, but it's hard to produce. That's where the effort is. So how do you keep that effort going? How do you keep the desire to continue to participate,
yes,
not just passively, but actively,
yes,
going?
Well, that's a very good question. And your maturity to have true enrollment conversations and commitment with people, you have to get connected to people again. Of what matters to them, what is happening inside their organization, what is their career goals, what are they really trying to hear to stop. People are hungry for that type of connection in this industry. And so I think it's a constant recreation of that and teaching people how to have those skills and how to develop that communication. We do a lot of webinars that we bring experts in. We have an annual summit over you know, once every year. We do a lot of meetings along the way, face-to-face type work. We go out with our members, and I'm constantly just getting in front with people.
Yeah.
And it is really good because I've been in the consulting world before. When I walk in with this role, I can just walk in and have a conversation about tech and actors without somebody thinking they're being sold anything.
Yeah.
And it's a different space. People talk. People want to learn. They want to know. And so when you start building that capability, and we have leadership involved in this. We have CISO working groups.
That's good.
You know, who are able to come in and share, well, how do I present this to the board? You know, what methodologies are you using? So it's that whole education enrollment of a community. It is truly community driven. And it takes it does take effort, and it does take engagement of, you know, of your membership and individual to be able to drive that home everywhere. But it's very possible.
That's a great place to end this, actually. So website, where do people find more information?
RHISAC.org.
That's actually very simple. I'm assuming, yes, how do people find you on Twitter or wherever?
You can email me at tommy.mcdowell@rhisac.org. And,
you have a Twitter account?
I do not have a Twitter account.
No Twitter account.
I do not have a Twitter account. Right. I stay off that kind of stuff.
You do actual work for a living, don't you?
In my past, I did anyway, so I try not to be involved in that kind of work.
What is the yearly? Our yearly get together.
It is in September this year,
okay,
in Denver, Colorado.
Wow! So, yeah. Folks, if you're out there in retail and or hospitality space, and you're wondering how do I get involved, how do they get involved?
You know, go to our website. You can register there. You can call me directly or email me, and somebody will get back with you.
Absolutely. All right, awesome, Tommy. Hey, this has been an exciting conversation. I appreciate it, folks. Thanks for listening. Hope you got something out of that. And if you're in the space, clearly. Something that you should probably be participating in at least the consumer, but hopefully on the producer side as well. And so for the Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast, this has been Raf, and we will see you another time, another place on another Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao, y'all.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.